Board, what we're trying to do is to study this period of the divided kingdom in our study of the history and geography of the Bible. And this period has parallel accounts from the Kings and the Chronicles. And Randy was noticing in my Bible, I believe on Friday, that I have an affection for stickies. They're really handy to mark the places where you're going to be going back and forth between two passages of study. And if you'll put a marker of some type in these places, it will be most helpful to you. For those of you who are new in our class, if you don't have a book, let me know, and we'll be sure that you get one, because it will be most helpful from the standpoint of the charts that are in that book, beginning on page 102. As we study the period of the divided kingdom. For those of you who are regulars in the class, we'd invite you to take out your books and turn to that page, page 102, and follow the chronology of the kings in Israel and the kings in Judah. And do please read the passages that are identified under the heading of these kings. The reason for that is it will help you to be most prepared for the class, as well follow the chart, and that lists some of the major events, though not all of the events in the life of those kings, but some of the major things that we're going to be talking about. So for now, if you would please, turn in your Bible to 1 Kings chapter 14. 1 Kings chapter 14. Another thought in preparation for the class. Be sure not only that you read from the biblical text, be aware that there are names that are used to identify kings in the Chronicles and in the Book of the Kings that are similar, though not identical. And sometimes the same man is called by two or three different names. And so be aware of that as you're studying. Don't let that bog you down or cause confusion. If you'll read the storyline, as it were, about the man, it becomes somewhat easier to see that it is talking about the same man. For example, he might be identified by who his mother is, who his son is, and so forth. So the events that transpired in his life. And so don't be confused by a little different spelling and so forth of the man's name. Now, we closed our study Wednesday. One important thought on that. In our study on Sunday morning and Wednesday night, we're running consistently or consecutive studies, same topic. So if you miss a portion of it, that is not good. I'd like for you to be here for all of it, if you can at all. If not, keep up the reading so you don't get behind. And we'll keep going with our study. In our study Wednesday night, the reason I bring that up is we were discussing Abijam, the son of Rehoboam. And he's called Abijam in the text of the Kings, but he's called Abijah in the text of the Chronicles. Same man. You'll see him described the same way. The events of his life are identical, so we're not talking about two different characters. Same man, different spelling. Our question Wednesday night was whether or not Abijam was a good king or was he really a bad king. Now, we do know that he expressed confidence in God. But the text tells us in the account of the kings that he walked in the sins, verse 3, 1 Kings chapter 15, 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 3, he walked in all the sins of his father, which he had done before him, and his heart was not perfect with Jehovah his God, as the heart of David his father. Now, just a note here, when you read of David his father, we know that David was not the immediate father of Abijam. Rehoboam was. And Rehoboam's father was Solomon, and Solomon's father was David. So the use of the expression his father doesn't necessitate the conclusion that that means that's who his daddy was. But what that does mean is that's who his forefather was. So you can trace that history back for those of you who might find that a bit confusing. But Abijam, or Abijah, as he's referred to in the Chronicles, was not a good king. Even though there were times that he expressed confidence in God. I want to call your attention to the account found in the Chronicles in 2 Chronicles chapter 13. So turn, if you will, in your Bible to 2 Chronicles chapter 13. We know that there was war between Jeroboam, the king of the northern 10 tribes after the period of the division, and Abijah, or Abijam, the son of Rehoboam. And in chapter 13 of 2 Chronicles, it tells us that Abijah, or Abijam, joined battle with an army of valiant men of war, even 400,000 chosen men. And Jeroboam set the battle in array against him with 800,000 chosen men who were mighty men of valor. Ken, ask you a question. How would you like to have an army of only 400,000, knowing that your opponent had twice as many soldiers as you do? Would you think that to be a wise move? Well, Abijam did, and he knew that God was with him. And as you'll notice in the text, beginning in verse 5, it says, "Ought ye not to know that Jehovah, the God of Israel, gave the kingdom over Israel to David forever, even to him and his sons, by a covenant of salt." Interesting to note that salt was very valuable, and it was used as a seal of a covenant. The price of the money was sometimes used to seal a deal, so to speak, as a commodity used in trade. And it was used here to seal this covenant. It says, "Yet Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the servant of Solomon, the son of David, rose up and rebelled against his Lord. And there were gathered unto him worthless men, base fellows, that strengthened themselves against Rehoboam and of Solomon, or Rehoboam the son of Solomon, when Rehoboam was young and tender-hearted and could not withstand them. And now ye think to withstand the kingdom of Jehovah in the hand of the sons of David. And ye are a great multitude, and there were with you the golden calves which Jeroboam made you for gods. Have ye not driven out the priests of Jehovah and the sons of Aaron and the Levites and made you priests after the manner of the peoples of other lands? So that whosoever cometh to consecrate himself with a young bullock and 7 rams, the same may be a priest of them that are no gods. But as for us, Jehovah is our God." Let's pause right there with verse 10. Going back, Joey, and reviewing just a little bit about what Jeroboam did is the reference here. What is it that Jeroboam did when the kingdom divided and Jeroboam became king of the northern 10 tribes? He had a fear of losing the loyalty of the people if they go back to Jerusalem, the place where God wanted them to go to worship Him. So what did Jeroboam do? All right, he did. Right at the border. And so his plan was, it's too much for you to go down there to Jerusalem to worship. So you go to Dan or you go to Bethel and worship there. Now, we note here that Abijah reminds Jeroboam and the northern 10 tribes, here's what you did. Now you come up against me with 400,000 men. Now, think about that. All right. Well, the fight is not necessarily territorial, but we've got a history in this. You remember going back even into the days of the judges. There were those who, of the northern portion of the land, even during the United Kingdom, that set themselves in array against the southern portion of the land. Same thing during the days of David.
But there's no immediate issue with them. You're just saying that this is just some long-standing war that's
It's a long-standing war that's been on and off for a long time. That's right. But yes, the major issue is the northern 10 tribes are worshiping idols. The southern tribe of Judah is being faithful to God, for the most part. Randy? Yes? That's right. That is correct. And, of course, the northern 10 tribes, the northern portion of Israel, became somewhat of a buffer for those of Judah, because if enemies come, we see Judah down here kind of landlocked. And if enemies come, before they get to Judah, they come through Israel. So all of these things become contributory factors to difficulties between the northern and the southern tribes. But I think, moreover, you've simply got a power issue. Jeroboam is afraid to lose the loyalty of the people. They'll go back to Rehoboam, is the context where he takes the throne and sets up these idols, the golden calves, for them to worship. I'll lose their loyalty. And so here you've got an issue of pride. Lots of shames in this period of history. Horrible, horrible things they ought to have been ashamed of. But they were not ashamed. In fact, by the time we come to the days of, interesting you use that word, interesting as we come to the days of Jeremiah, Jeremiah identifies in chapter 6 a host of things that they did, and they said, were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? Nay, they were not at all ashamed. So yes, there were many things they should have been ashamed of. But at this particular point, we've got this battle between the northern and the southern kingdom. And Abijam is determined that because God has fought their battles in the past, He will fight their battles now. And when you look at the northern 10 tribes, it's the northern 10 tribes that have rejected God and worshiped the golden calves. And it's Jeroboam, their king, who has rejected the priesthood that God has anointed, and he has anointed his own priesthood. He has rejected the feast days that God has appointed, and he's injected his own feast days to correspond with those. No. No, and Abijam is reminding him of that. Yes. If you look at verse 10 now, pick up the reading, 2 Chronicles chapter 13, beginning at verse 10. It says, "But as for us, Jehovah is our God, and we have not forsaken Him. And we have priests ministering unto Jehovah, the sons of Aaron, and the Levites in their work." Well, this was how God had prescribed it. In verse 11, "And they burn unto Jehovah every morning and every evening, burnt offerings and sweet incense, the showbread. Also they set in order upon the pure table and the candlestick of gold and the lamps thereof to burn every evening. For we keep the charge of Jehovah our God, but ye have forsaken Him. And behold, God is with us at our head, and His priest with the trumpets of alarm to sound an alarm against you. O children of Israel, fight ye not against Jehovah, the God of your fathers, for ye shall not prosper." Now, that's the words of Abijam, or Abijah, as he's referred to in the parallel account. Now, as we look at this, it appears that Abijam is having great confidence in God. Now, that was the substance of our question that we left class with on Wednesday night. Was he a good king or was he a bad king? Well, we noted that he followed in the sins of Rehoboam. Rehoboam ended on a sour note. He was not a good king. Abijam begins on a sour note. He was really not a good king. But in this contest with Jeroboam, he expresses faith and confidence in God because of what God has done in the past. Now, look, if you will, in verse 13. Jeroboam not to be outdone. You know, strategy is a part of battle, is it not? Not to be outdone. He has twice as many men as Abijam does. So when Abijam confronts the men of Jeroboam, he confronts 400,000 with his 400,000. But where's the other part of Jeroboam's army? They're back behind him, you see. So here you're facing an army in front of you when you're unaware of the fact that your enemy has created an ambush behind you. And so here you are defying this king with his army in front of you, unaware that he has thousands of soldiers right behind you. Now, Ken, would you be real brave at this point, or would you begin to think, God's going to be there for me? All right. Well, let's pick up the reading there, beginning about verse 13. It says, "But Jeroboam caused an ambush to come about behind them, so they were before Judah, and the ambushment was behind them. And when Judah looked back, behold, the battle was before and behind them. And they cried unto Jehovah, and the priests sounded with the trumpets, and the men of Judah gave a shout. And as the men of Judah shouted, it came to pass that God smote Jeroboam and all Israel before Abijah and Judah, and the children of Israel fled before Judah, and God delivered them into their hands. And Abijah and his people slew them with a great slaughter. So there fell down, slain of Israel, 500,000 chosen men. Thus the children of Israel were brought under at that time, and the children of Judah prevailed, because they relied upon Jehovah." Let's notice that. Now, though Abijam had done some bad things in following in the steps of his father, at least at this point, his confidence in God served a purpose. The confidence of the people of God, Judah, served a purpose. God delivered their enemies into their hands. Yes. Yes. Ideally, you'd like to think that they would get that message, wouldn't you? Yeah. Richard?
I'm going to say also, it's interesting to note here that Abijam went off and attacked Jeroboam. God refused to allow Rehoboam.
Yes.
So Jeroboam has become more complete in his sense, having set up the idols of the den of Bethel. So I think that's probably why this is not allowed to do that.
Yes, likely so. Time for judgment. It's time for judgment, yes. So Abijam and Jeroboam fought in the hill country there, and Jeroboam was very much defeated. Notice, if you will, in verse 20, it says in chapter 13 of 2 Chronicles, "Neither did Jeroboam recover strength again in the days of Abijah, and Jehovah smote him, and he died." Now, Abijah, verse 21, "waxed mighty and took unto himself 14 wives and begat 22 sons and 16 daughters. And the rest of the acts of Abijah and his ways and his sayings are written in the commentary of the prophet Iddo. Now, question. What had God said about the king's multiplying wives? And here we need a passage. Don't do that. Don't multiply wives. Passage. This is one that's in your list to remember. So if you've got a piece of paper in your Bible where you have that list, it'd be a good time to look at it. Deuteronomy something, yes. Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17. The kings were not to multiply wives. Now, we're going to be, or have, studied about David. What did David do? He multiplied wives. He took the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And I think she was wife number what? 11. And we know that Solomon multiplied wives. How many wives did Solomon have? Several. 700 wives and 300 concubines. God was displeased. And now here we read of this man who did not do what was right. He too has multiplied wives. So to generally characterize Abijam or Abijah, we would characterize him as a bad king. Yes. Yes, isn't that interesting? Very good observation. I had not really noticed that emphatically. Very good. Very good. All right, now work. Well, now that's not good. There we go. All right, and that gets us to that point. Very good. It's interesting to note, Joey, and perhaps there are a couple of passages that we need to inject here as you brought that point up, just for clarification. Just because a man is not zapped out of the world because of something that we see as sinful in his life does not necessarily mean that God condones or approves of that action or that conduct. And a good passage that helps us, I think, with that is found in Acts chapter 14. In Acts chapter 14. In Acts chapter 14, the Apostle Paul is preaching in Lystra. And as he preaches in Lystra, you'll notice in this particular incident, he's preaching to folks who are of Gentile background. And that means that they were worshipers of idols, and they're about to make Paul and Barnabas into some kind of gods over their protest. But we note in verse 16, as he speaks of God, he said, "Who in the generations gone by suffered all the nations to walk in their own ways." That's interesting to me. Allowed them to walk in their own ways. We see things that characterize the life of David, the life of Solomon. These were among the people of God. We see characters that were not Israelites, that is, those of the Gentile world. And we say, well, why did God just zap them off the face of the earth? His plan, his scheme of redemption was not fulfilled. Time was not yet full. And so he allowed things. And as far as an explanation of why, we just have to pass over that. We're not given those details. We just simply make the observation that this was displeasing. Right. That's right. And you'd find that where? All right, Acts 17, 30, 31, okay? I pick on Joey all the time. Yes, he has. Yes, he has. Remind me to fix that. Is that what locked me up? Well, we'll just fix that right away because I don't want that locking up my computer. I forget to turn my email off, and sometimes that makes a ding when it shouldn't make a ding. All right, Asa. Let's talk a little bit about Asa. And if you'll notice, for purposes of convenience, I've tried to put on our chart in red letters the context that we will mostly be looking at of the parallel. Here's 1 Kings 15 and 16. If you're reading the account of Asa in the book of the Kings, and if you're reading the account in the Chronicles, here's the passage that we will be looking at. So if it's in red, I'm going to go there first. Just a hint. Okay.
It's not like he just died like that. It's more than that sometimes he died.
Right, right, yeah. As a judgment of God. Well, that's a good point. And, of course, keeping in mind, too, that Jeroboam becomes the standard of an evil king. Others are compared to him in the inspired text. Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that later. All right, when we talk about Asa, king in Judah, I'd also want to call your attention to the chart in your lesson book. Notice on the charts that we have before you, we will identify where this man was king. Look back just a little. Abijam, king in Judah. Go back. Jeroboam, king in Israel. Okay, so notice what's in the parentheses, and we'll try to keep straight running with the charts that are in your lesson book so you know where we are discussing this man to be king of Judah or king of Israel. And we'll try to bring the two lines of kings down somewhat together. So study carefully from the chart that is in your book. When we look at the account in the Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 14, beginning at verse 2, it tells us that Asa did that which was right or good and right in the sight or in the eyes of Jehovah his God. Of course, verse 1 simply tells us that Abijah died. He slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David. And Asa, his son, reigned in his stead in the land, in his days, the land was quiet 10 years. Now, question. There's a rule that had been stated by Moses way back yonder when they were coming up out of the land of Egypt, that if you do what God says, He'll bless you. If you do not do what God says, He'll curse you. Time for review. Where is it? Deuteronomy what? 4, yes. Again in Deuteronomy. 8, again in Deuteronomy. 28 through 30, that's right. Joshua, when he brought them into the land, told them the same thing when he had completed his work in delivering the land unto them, as their military leader, and divided it among the tribes. He told them the same thing. You do what God says, He'll bless you. You worship idols, He'll curse you. Where did Joshua tell them that? Joshua, well, he had fulfilled it in Joshua 21, 44, and 45, and then 23, 14 through 16 is where we see the promise of if you worship idols, He'll drive you out of the land. Of course, Randy, you and I were discussing that these are not the only times where that threat is made. It's repeated a host of times to various individuals, and perhaps I need to just put together a list of them and we can present that. But when we talk about Asa, he's a good king. What would you expect then for God to do during the time of Asa? You would expect there to be quietness in the land. He wouldn't be embroiled in battle all the days of his life. But as you look at verse 2, we see that he did good things. Continue, if you will, in verse 3, and let's see what good things that he did. In verse 3, it tells us that he took away the foreign altars and the high places and break down the pillars, and he hewed down the Asherim. And he commanded Judah to seek Jehovah, the God of their fathers, and to do the law and the commandment. Also, he took away out of the cities of Judah the high places and the sun images, and the kingdom was quiet before him, and he built fortified cities in Judah, for the land was quiet, and he had no war in those years, because Jehovah had given him rest. Let's pause there in the reading. Now, when it tells us that he break down the high places, and the sun images, what is it that Asa is doing? Ridding the land of idolatry. That's right. Getting rid of all of these places. Now, my brother, a year or so ago, made a journey over into this part of the country, and he sent back some photographs of idols or altars that had been broken down. And I thought it was interesting that they have survived all these years. But what has survived is a rock with an image on it that has a portion of it that's broken and dashed off, or it has a big crack down through it. And the idea is these were desecrated in that way. Doesn't mean they ceased to exist. Some of them are still there, but they are, as far as their use is concerned, they're desecrated. They're destroyed. You can't use them in worship to the idol, which if you take a sledgehammer to that thing and tear it up, it's still there. You can still perhaps see a piece of the image or see something that would tell you what it is. But as far as its function is concerned, it's destroyed. Now, this is what Asa did. He got rid of them. He destroyed them. They were no longer useful to worship these idols. Now that's one of the things that we're going to talk about that just a little bit later. You remember when the young prophet came to the idol, the golden calf that Jeroboam had set up in Bethel. What was it that the young prophet said would eventually happen on that altar? They would burn the bones of the prophets, these false prophets, as it were, on that altar. Well, what would that do? That would desecrate the altar, much like who was the king of Syria that brought the pigs into the temple and offered them on the altar. What was his name? Help me out there, Richard. What was his name? Yes, Antiochus Epiphanes. That's right, who brought those in. Of course, the idea was to desecrate the altar of God in the temple. So that's what some did. But this is what Asa did. He put away the idols from the land. Yes?
I think we have there's a difference in the text between 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing.
Okay. Correct.
Mm-hmm.
It could possibly be that. Some have suggested as a solution to that, that what we suggested about breaking the altar or desecrating the place of worship may have been involved, but what should have been done is completely remove all of it. And they didn't do that. They left remnants of where it had taken place. And, of course, when that occurs, sometimes it's a temptation to rebuild the thing. And if you're going to tear it down, probably a good idea just to completely destroy it and remove it, get rid of it. So I've heard both of those as an explanation. But be that as it may, that's a good observation. Now, when we look at what Asa did, and, of course, keep your fingers in these two places, of the account of the Kings and the Chronicles. But we're reading now from the Chronicles, 2 Chronicles chapter 14, so please don't get lost. It tells us in verse 7, "For he said unto Judah, Let us build these cities, and make about them walls and towers, gates and bars. The land is yet before us. Because we have sought Jehovah our God, we have sought Him, and He hath given us rest on every side. So they built and prospered. And Asa and an army that bare bucklers and spears out of Judah 300,000, and out of Benjamin that bare shields and drew bows 280,000, all these were mighty men of valor. Now, when you look at that, you say Asa maintains a standing army that's well prepared. His confidence is in God. Well, as we begin the ninth verse of chapter 14, there's a hiccup in the things that are going on. What is it? The Ethiopians. Now, if you're looking at a map, I don't have one in the sequence of my charts to just readily flash up there, but if you're looking at a map, Ethiopia would be some distance, would it not, from the land of Judah? I wonder where you got that. That's a very good observation. And it is. And Acts chapter 8's relevance is, here is a man from Ethiopia who has traveled to Jerusalem, and he's on his way back, and evangelist Philip is preaching to him. And we've noted the distance there in times gone by to show that Ethiopian in Acts chapter 8 evidently was a very religious man to travel by way of chariot that large distance to Jerusalem to worship God. So yes, that's very good observation as well. So Ethiopia has traveled quite some distance, the people, to fight against Asa and the people of Judah. But what does Asa do in response? Verse 11. He cried unto God. And he said, Jehovah, there is none beside thee to help between the mighty and him that hath no strength. Help us, O Jehovah our God, for we rely on thee, and in thy name are we come against this multitude. O Jehovah, thou art God. Let not man prevail against us. So Jehovah smote the Ethiopians before Asa and before Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. And Asa and the people that were with him pursued them unto Gerar. And there fell of the Ethiopians so many that they could not recover themselves, for they were destroyed before Jehovah, before his host, and they carried away very much booty. And they smote all the cities round about Gerar, for the fear of Jehovah came upon them. And they despoiled all the cities, for there was much spoil in them. And they smote also the tents of cattle, and carried away sheep in abundance and camels, and returned to Jerusalem. So the Ethiopians were destroyed. Notice, if you will, how many Ethiopians came against them. 1,000,000. Back up, if you will, to verse 9. It says, and there came out against them Zerah the Ethiopian with an army of 1,000,000. And 300 chariots, and came to Marisha. Then Asa went out to meet him. So how would you like to, with your army of 400,000 men, Joey, go up against 1,000,000 Ethiopians? Well, it might be. How many were in Asa's army? Verse 8, yes, okay, verse 8. Yes, verse 8. So now you've got 1,000,000 men that you're facing with a small army. Yeah. Yes. Prevail against thee. Yeah. Let no man prevail against thee. I may have misread it. Yeah. That's right. That's right. The battle is the Lord's. 580,000. You did the math. Good. 580,000. Well, still, that's rather small when you compare it to a million. God fought the battle. Indeed. So, Judah, then, was delivered from the Ethiopians and his army. And Asa enjoyed many years of peace because he was faithful. Now, those of the northern kingdom, when we look at the northern kingdom under the leadership of Jeroboam, we don't want to come away with the impression that everybody in the northern kingdom has forsaken God. Because now we find that some in the northern kingdom are coming down to Judah and being faithful under the leadership of the kings, for the most part, the kings of Judah. Any questions or comments just here? Yes, Joey? Okay. Okay, we need to talk about that. Yes. Yes. All right. All right. Historically, that's been true. Yes. God allowed, as it were, Satan to tempt Job. But God didn't tempt Job. He allowed Satan to tempt Job. But Job was victorious. And that, I think, perhaps becomes a very prominent illustration. Yeah. Yeah. He allowed him to tempt. Well, yeah, but I like the point. God allows evil people to do evil things, and that's a valid point. And we're going to see that just because someone starts out being a good person doesn't mean they're going to always be a good person either. And we'll note this in the instance of Asa, for example. In the 15th chapter, we want to see that Asa was very productive. Many reforms. In chapter 15, 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 15. It says, "And the Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded. And he went out to meet Asa and said unto him, Hear ye me, Asa, and all Judah and Benjamin. Jehovah is with you while ye are with him. And if ye seek him, he will be found of you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you." Randy, there's another one to put in our list, where the promise is blessings and curses. You do what God says, for 2 Chronicles 15, verse 2, and God will bless you. If you don't do what God says, then God will curse you. Go back to chapter 13 and look at verse 18. Concerning Abijah, the victory that he enjoyed was because they relied upon Jehovah. In chapter 14, in verse 11, one of Asa's previous victories, as we just discussed concerning the Egyptians, was because he relied upon Jehovah. In chapter 14, backing up there to verse 6, it tells us because Jehovah had given him rest. In verse 4, it was because he sought God and he followed God's commandments. Isn't that simple? So this is repeated Time and time and time and time again. Yes. That is right. That is right. That's right. The 15th chapter identifies a number of reforms that Asa put into play. You'll note in verse 8, for example, "And when Asa heard these words and the prophecy of Oded the prophet, he took courage and put away the abominations out of all the land of Judah and Benjamin, and out of the cities which he had taken from the hill country of Ephraim. And he renewed the altar of Jehovah, which was before the porch of Jehovah. And he gathered all Judah and Benjamin, and them that sojourned with them out of Manasseh," or Ephraim and Manasseh, "and out of Simeon. And they fell to him out of Israel in abundance when they saw that Jehovah his God was with him." So here we see an exodus of those who are faithful to God from the northern 10 tribes coming down and joining those of the southern kingdom. It says, "So they gathered themselves together at Jerusalem on the third month," etc., etc. And we read of their offerings and so forth. But if you'll drop down to verse 15, "And all Judah rejoiced at the oath, for they had sworn with all their heart and sought him with their whole desire, and he was found of them, and Jehovah gave them rest round about." Things are good, at least at this point, during the reign of King Asa. Notice the last paragraph of this chapter. It says, "And also Maacah, the mother of Asa, the king, he removed from being queen." His own mother. Why? She worshipped idols. That's right. Because she had made an abomination, or an abominable image for an Asherah, or Asherah, and Asa cut down her image and made dust of it and burned it at the brook Kidron. But the high places were not taken away out of Israel. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was perfect in all his days. And he brought into the house of God the things that his father had dedicated, and that he himself had dedicated, silver and gold and vessels. And there was no more war unto the 35th year in the reign of Asa. Chapter 16, next time, okay? We'll see where Asa played politics and things were not good.